I'm Megana Slatiel.
Devin Fine.
You're listening to Europe in the World, a podcast where we explore migration policy and practice in the European Union. We're joined today with three guests who will help us to explore how migration policy has changed since the wave in 2015 and where the EU is trying to go in the future.
Today we'll hear from Dr. Felipe de Broeker, Dr. Greta Brockman, and Dr. Jan Schneider, all experts in EU migration policy. They talk to us about the Dublin Regulation, the vulnerabilities of the system and its consequences for migrants, and the EU's responses, such as the strengthening of external border security and the new pact on migration and asylum currently being hashed out by the member states.
In many ways, the migration story in Europe starts in Germany. So first, we asked Dr. Jan Schneider to walk us through what migration looked like in German society in 2015.
What happened in 2015 was nothing that just started on the 1st of January 2015 or in the September of 2015. It sort of built up over a couple of years before that.
That was Dr. Jan Schneider, head of the research unit and deputy managing director of the German Expert Council on Integration. Prior to that, he also held positions with the German Federal Office for Migration and Refugees, the Hamburg Institute of International Economics, and the German Federal Agency for Civic Education.
And that was actually a situation of extreme concentration of refugees from the Syrian conflict, from the Syrian civil war, in first countries of asylum such as Turkey and other countries, where millions of refugees from the Syrian war were just sort of waiting in a situation that became unbearable for them as the international community cut down on the delivery of food and basic services to these refugees. So a lot of them made their way to Central Europe. And that started actually already at the end of 2013 and during 2014, and just hit the peak in 2015 in that what some people call the long summer of migration, starting in August, September 2015 and lasting until the end of the year, where altogether slightly around 1 million people arrived in Germany. Most of them from Syria, but also a lot of people from Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries, which had to be hosted, which had to be put under a roof, and whose applications for international protection had to be processed in the months and years to follow. So it really changed not only the burden on administration in terms of processing all these asylum claims, it also changed the picture of inner cities in Germany, because these 1 million refugees were sort of dispersed in the whole country, and you would see them in this first warm summer evenings and days, sometimes out on the street and trying to find a roof over their top. And a lot of people, including ourselves, sort of provided shelter for 1 or 2 days until the authorities were ready to host these people. So it's really an extremely exciting situation in that late summer of 2015, which sort of turned into a long ongoing situation of administrative burden and work to process all these asylum claims. Because, as you know, it's an asylum application is nothing that you just decide within 20 minutes. There needs to be an interview. There needs to be excessive research on the situation in the country of origin to determine whether the person has a right to stay or not. I think the wave of immigration in 2015, 2016, as did the wave of immigration in 2022 by Ukrainians coming to Germany, changed the face of the country to some extent, because those were significant numbers. And they were settling in all parts of the country, really changing the face of cities, changing the face of schools, particularly with a lot of young people going to school, and eventually also changing the demographic profile of Germany over the years.
What made Germany more willing to accept refugees as opposed to other countries at the time? And was the public on board at first?
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes from an outside perspective, I think it seems as if Germany sort of stood out as the humanitarian champion within Europe by hosting that many refugees. Actually, from a German perspective, at the time, Sweden stood out as the humanitarian hero in Europe, because they hosted the highest number of refugees if compared to their overall population, because that's, I think, what you always have to bear in mind when looking at figures and at numbers of refugees taken in. It's not necessarily just the absolute number. I mean, it's gigantic. 1 million Syrians, 1 million Ukrainians in Germany. But we have to look at our overall population, which stands at 82 or 83 million. So it's still a lot, but it's not a complete overburdening, whereas other countries compared to their population took in actually more refugees as per ratio per, let's say, 1,000 population. So but what made Germany willing to accept those people? I mean, it was in some way was inevitable to accept them, because Europe is actually one huge area with free movement. So there is border controls on Europeans' external borders, but according to the Schengen principle, there is no internal border. So once refugees enter the European Union by way of crossing rivers or crossing the Mediterranean Sea and reach the Greek islands or the Italian coast or Poland from the east, they're actually free to move. And that's what people did, what actually also people did in August and September of 2015, when many thousands of them arrived in Budapest, and when the situation there on the so-called Western Balkans route became unbearable, because countries like Hungary were not able to host and feed these people anymore. In margins, they also didn't really want to host and feed them. So countries like Austria and Germany at the time agreed to open the pathways, to even provide infrastructure for them to move on and to sort of reach a dispersal of those refugees across Europe without individual countries being overburdened. The alternative, of course, would have been to close down borders in breach of the Schengen border. I think it was mainly Chancellor Merkel's position at that time not to do it, because she strongly believed in the European Union and the free movement, and not to close down the borders, but instead proclaim the famous German saying, wir schaffen das, we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm. What was the turning point between accepting migrants to a shift in attitude against solidarity?
I wouldn't even say there was sort of a fixed breaking or turning point, where I don't think we can depict such a turning point. And I also wouldn't say that society has completely lost solidarity with refugees. That's not the case. We just recently did an online survey, almost representative online survey among many thousand people in Germany, and there is still a high level of solidarity and of readiness to help people who come as refugees at the individual basis. So we ask questions such as, would you engage in supporting somebody with going to the authorities and helping him or her with their paperwork or whatever? So questions like those, would you in a situation of emergency, would you host somebody in your home if you had the space for it? Yes, no. These kind of questions. And we can still see that there is a solid level of solidarity among the general population. However, you're of course right that the public attitude has sort of shifted against migration, and one result is that we have had for the last months again, and even 1 or 2 years, a much higher voter turnout for the right-wing alternative for Germany party in several elections at the state level and in several elections at local and municipal level. And so it is we have to differentiate between the individual feeling or sentiment of solidarity towards refugees, which is still high, which is lower than it was maybe a couple of years ago, but which is still relatively high, and a level of protest against a policy which is sometimes exacerbated or amplified by media coverage, in the sense that this is all too much, this is all too costly, why are these high numbers of people coming here, we need to end this at some point. And I would say the particular due to media coverage and also stories by policymakers from the right-wing parties or the right-wing party AfD, this narrative gained quite a bit of support, and that is reflected in, let's say, something between 15 and 20% of the population who vote for this party. And I think we're at that point right now where politics has not been able to rhetorically lead a way out of the situation and put a positive narrative about, around this migration. And part of this might also be because of the lack of solidarity towards taking in asylum seekers in the European Union. If we look at the willingness of EU member states, and we have 27 of them, over the past 10 years, we see clear shifts. And this readiness for burden sharing, this readiness to engage in a joint or common European refugee policy, of course, also changes with the color of government. So we have seen changes according to the government. We just recently saw the results of the general elections in the Netherlands with the landslide victory of the right-wing party there. We're not clear who's going to be in government soon, but if this party is part of the government, there will be, of course, a leap towards less willingness to accept migrants and refugees in the Netherlands, which traditionally used to be also one of the pillars of humanitarian policy.
We started our story in Germany, but Germany was not the only country overburdened with migrants in 2015. Public and disproportionate overcrowding in countries such as Italy and Greece have also dominated the news. In order to understand why few member states seem to carry most of the refugees, we need to go back and understand the Dublin Regulation. The Dublin Regulation first came into force in 1997, and in 2013, Dublin II critically established the criteria and mechanisms for determining which single state is responsible for examining an application for asylum. Our next guest gave us a rundown of how this works in practice.
First question, is the Dublin process an effective means of managing migration in Europe?
No, I think that would be a strong exaggeration.
Dr. Greta Brochmann, a professor of sociology and social geography at the University of Oslo. She previously led a government commission on international migration and the Norwegian welfare model, and has also previously held positions with the Research Council of Norway, the Norwegian Refugee Council, Peace Research Institute Oslo, and the European Science Foundation.
I mean, the Dublin system has not functioned efficiently or functioned well. And that's the major reason why we're now having a development with all asylum and migration policies. That's sort of an attempt to accommodate some of the problems that have been facing Europe within the Dublin thinking. But I mean, the Dublin Convention and now also the pact comes about as an answer to the differences within the EU. I mean there is a divide north south and east west in many ways, and the major problem with the former regime is that the countries closer to the Mediterranean, particularly Greece and Italy, also to a certain extent Spain, have received the larger share of immigrants from the global south, because they're closest to the gateway, so to speak. And since the Dublin Regulation says that it's the first country of asylum that is supposed to process the application, then Italy and Greece has had an unjustified part of the European burden when it comes to asylum reception, and they have been increasingly frustrated and angry on the rest of EU because of that fact, and also on many occasions due to this overload in Greece and Italy, they have not abided by the Dublin system in terms of registering all people who arrive and seek asylum. Instead, they have just let them through and then let them move north.
without registering them, which means that the Dublin Convention cannot be without registration in the southern countries. When they reach a northern country, they are not registered. So therefore, it's the northern country that then will have to take their asylum application into the process. And this is a sort of a tacit undermining of the Dublin system, and one can understand very, very well, because it has not been a fair system as it stands. When all registered asylum seekers in Italy and Greece, if they manage to move on, they should be sent back to Italy and Greece according to the Dublin system. And this whole Dublin thing, it broke down under the refugee crisis in 2015. So that was sort of a real, really strong push to find alternative ways to handle the issues, and also to handle the so-called burden sharing system that for many years had not been any kind of a success within the EU. The number of asylum seekers were so extremely different in different parts of Europe. And on the one hand, you had the southern European countries taking this first step burden, and then also parts of northern Europe taking a disproportional part of the asylum seekers, because they were very attractive in terms of welfare systems and secure surroundings and fairly generous asylum system, by and large, generally speaking. So, I mean, you have had different axis of division within the European context, and it has made the system quite dysfunctional in many ways.
So one thing I found really interesting was that you noted that asylum seekers often learn about like the conditions of the Dublin regulations or like the process of asylum seeking in the EU by word of mouth from other asylum seekers while en route to Europe or after they arrive. So do you think these conditions need to be better publicized or translated? Or is there a way to do that? And would it have any effect on the desires of migrants trying to enter the EU?
Well, apparently, and according to the research I've done myself in the Italian context, asylum seekers are surprisingly well informed about the procedures in Europe. And I think many of them are informed, or sometimes also wrongly, by the traffickers. I mean, most of them depend on trafficking, and they are informed, I mean, how to behave and how to act when they arrive on the European soil. And I think, more information about the formal situation would probably not be indicate a big difference, because I mean it's a big risk to try to go over the Mediterranean and try to get a foothold on the EU soil in the first place. So people know that they're taking a huge risk, and they also know from relatives and acquaintances and also traffickers that if they manage to get into Europe, the likelihood of being able to stay on is fairly high, even though their application is not accepted, because the European countries, for the time being, they are not very efficient in terms of sending people back, the people who have not got accepted as refugees. So people in many European contexts, they stay on without papers. Many people for quite some years, and they will have difficulties in accessing legal work. They will have difficulties in accessing social rights, etc., etc. But this is a social fact, nevertheless, that people know that if you accept the poor conditions of not being a legal resident and trying to find your way in the labor market without permissions and all that, you will possibly have a possibility of staying on. And that is part of the motivation on the EU side for this pact I mentioned earlier, because the return policy is a very central aspect of the pact suggestion. But whether the EU countries will be able to return people in any better way than before the pact is one of the reasons why I doubt that the pact will really change that much in the end. But that was according to the jurisdiction that existed at that time. I mean, it wasn't legal to try get a second chance in another country. And the problem was that they knew that the living conditions were so substantially better in Scandinavia, for instance, than it was in Italy. In Italy, they had very, very poor living conditions. They were not being given housing and no welfare rights, etc., etc. Whereas acquaintances of those people we spoke to in Norway or Sweden, Denmark, could tell that they got all the goods. I mean, the housing, education, access to the labor market, etc., etc. So, I mean, the differences also within the EU in terms of living standard and social rights as a refugee would also make people want to move on, even though they were accepted as refugees and given protection. And this is not according to how the system was supposed to work, and therefore it was important principally for the countries up north, the secondary countries, to send people back, to sort of educate the countries in the south that it wouldn't be a good idea to just, I mean, count on this secondary acceptance.
So now that we've established that the Dublin system has put Europe in a bind, how can they break out of it? As Dr. Brockman mentioned, the new pact on migration and asylum is meant to fix these issues of uneven burden sharing. But will it, and will it even pass? Back to Dr. Schneider for more on that.
At the moment, it is extremely difficult to work towards sort of an ideal picture where, let's say, in my world, I would say we receive a certain number of refugees at the borders of the European Union, and they are distributed according to the fair key to all the member states who process them according to the common and joint principles. So this is really far away at the moment. However, I think policymakers and also researchers should keep up that idea that we need some sort of solidarity, because otherwise the European project as such is in danger. Particularly the Schengen free movement is at stake if we don't consider this a common ground and a common area for asylum as well.
So how does the new pact on migration then, like, actually how does it address those concerns regarding the unequal, like, burden sharing?
I wouldn't say not at all, but it hardly addresses the issue of unequal burden sharing. So and the ideas of the pact are not yet part of the law. I mean, as we speak, we're having hot talks and negotiations behind the scenes in Brussels and Strasbourg between the European Parliament and the European Council on the contents of this reform. And the reform will come into force before the end of the legislative period of the European Parliament, which is next summer. So what is introduced is a very reluctant solidarity mechanism. Member states were not ready to agree on a fixed system of distribution of refugees, let's say, according to their economic power and their overall population. That would be the two indicators that might be the most relevant for finding a formula on how to distribute. They were not ready to do that. There was no possibility to reach that goal, which some of the big refugee receiving countries like Germany have been favoring for quite a while. So, however, the European Commission and also some of those strong member states, including the so-called frontline southern European member states, such as Italy and Greece, where most of the people who come to Europe by boat arrive, they insisted on at least some sort of solidarity mechanism. And that says for that future plan, if it comes into force, that annually the European Union will redistribute up to 30,000 people who look for asylum and who arrive at European borders according to a distribution key to other countries. However, with the provision that member states can also provide other services instead of taking in refugees. And that's, for instance, paying money or sending expert personnel to the European level. So it was much criticized that countries such as Hungary, who resist any refugee take-in, could actually just buy themselves out of the solidarity mechanism by paying. However, this payment will be quite significant. If you consider 30,000 people to be distributed among a member state, each and every member state would receive a certain quota. So if the member state is not taking in the quota, they would have to pay that money into a fund. So that's at least some sort of contribution, which I think is better than having nothing at all. But that's basically the only slight glimpse of solidarity and fairness within the system when it gets to sharing the burden.
It doesn't actually address the issue of solidarity. It just gives them like a financial out.
What remains the biggest challenge to implementing more effective reforms in the burden sharing process and in the EU migration policies more generally?
Yeah, I think the big challenge is, and as I mentioned before, Germany is not an outlier in the sense that migration is always a hot topic that can be used for popularistic debates. It's the same thing in other EU member states. It's even more so the case in other member states. It's much easier in the Visegrad states like Poland, like Slovakia, like Hungary, to publicly use migration as a topic to raise concerns and outrage. So I think the challenge really is to get 27 governments, 27 interests among one roof and find the golden formula that everybody's happy with. It's never going to be everyone that's happy with it, but we even don't get to the point where compromises are easily to be made. I mean, we have to imagine that how many thousands of hours are negotiated behind back doors to just find some very mediocre compromise on some of those issues, which don't mean anything in terms of a better refugee distribution or a solidarity mechanism. So I think the challenge remains that some countries are really trying to get out of the system of refugee intake, which they are not allowed to do because otherwise they would have to leave the European Union. But they're keeping up their resistance to the last point. To not take in refugees and are negotiating things that we now see in that compromise on paper, and that's sort of a surrogate mechanism for not taking in refugees. To make it more, I think the ideal picture of having a fair system of distributing refugees across the European Union would help for a big part, but as this is not in reach at all, the consensus is sought more in the area of border protection, in the area of enforcing returns, at the area of defining third countries as safe third countries that the European Union can send people back to. That's where is the biggest ground for common interests of EU member states, and that's also what's sort of reflecting from these reform plans right now, that there's going to be a whole new system of trying to keep as many irregular migrants outside of the European Union and not even let them in, not having to touch the problem of distribution within the European Union.
As working to rebuild migration policy in the European Union seems very far off and somewhat unrealistic, our next guest brought up an alternative solution that the EU is pursuing. He argues that where the EU has been successful is in strengthening its external borders.
So, well, I think that we are now in the process of consolidating more and more the Frontex agency, and that could become bit by bit, very progressively, as it will take a lot of time, it could become a federal agency.
That was Dr. Philippe de Brucker, a professor of immigration and asylum law and the free movement of European citizens at the University of Brussels and the European Law Center. He's also a guest lecturer at Sciences Po in Paris, as well as universities of Bayonne, Provence, Luxembourg, and Madrid from 2001 to 2004. He was the main administrator at the European Commission's Directorate General for Justice and Home Affairs. And in 2011, he was the Jean Monnet Chair for European Immigration and Asylum Law. He also helped found the EU Agency for Asylum Training Program.
It would then replace the border guards employed by the member states, the national border guards. But there is still a long way to go before this. You know that the European integration is a step-by-step process. It very often requires a crisis to do some progress, and we will see what's going to happen in the future. But I think that we go more and more into a direction of a federal agency, of a kind of federal agency, and this is probably the only solution to establish then solidarity between the member states, because then it would mean that this agency is entirely funded by the EU budget, so that the burden is then distributed equally between the member states.
So you also noted that you thought a fully fledged European agency with sole border control prerogative would be politically unacceptable. What would happen for this to change? What would have to happen for this to change?
Well, what would happen, I mean, is once again a crisis with what could happen, and it happened already in 2015-16, when one member state like Greece lost total control over its borders, so that almost 1 million of people managed to enter the European Union through Greece and then went to the northern and the western part of the European Union. So if, and this explains that actually the European Border and Coast Guard was created in 2016. It was really the result of that crisis. So if such a crisis would once again take place, we can then think that we will progress with strengthening the Frontex agency, but it will only be a bit by bit process, because there is no consensus about federalism in the European Union. There are very divergent views, and it's only if it shows that it is absolutely necessary that people will accept that Frontex becomes a kind of federal agency, and maybe totally federal, but a kind of.
And on that note, do you think that the EU is failing to promote a common border policy, especially as it relates to border enforcement and regulation?
I don't think that the EU is really failing to control its borders, because controlling borders, and in particular land borders, is always extremely difficult. And we have a lot of examples abroad showing that controlling borders is a very difficult job. I think of the United States and the border with Mexico. It is very clear that even a country like the United States has a lot of difficulties to control this border. So I would not say that the EU is failing, but it is indeed a very difficult job. As I just mentioned, solidarity will be necessary in relation with those asylum border procedures, because then it means, of course, that the burden will rely upon the member states located at the external borders. And they of course, obviously, will not accept to do the job for the others without solidarity, without help. If asylum border procedures do not function, and if those member states located at the external border do not receive enough solidarity, then we can again enter into a type of chaos. This will then, as a consequence, mean that those member states will then re-establish internal border controls within the Schengen area, and this would then endanger free movement within the Schengen area. So this is one scenario if the border member states fail to implement asylum border procedure. Another scenario is that those member states will try to do all what they can to close the border, and then that they would start to return asylum seekers without examining their claim, and this would be a violation of the principle of non-refoulement, which is the key principle under Article 33 of the Geneva Convention on the Status of Refugees. And then that would be, and that would endanger the right to asylum. Another consequence could be that then the EU would try to externalize more and more its asylum policy and asking neighboring member states to prevent people to reach the borders of the European Union. So more and more of what we call externalization in terms of blocking people in countries of transit. And of course, that's also a scheme which would create problems. First of all, it's a violation of the right to leave any country, which is a human right for every human being. And also, it means that the EU is totally dependent upon the goodwill of those transit states to keep their border closed for preventing migrants to leave. They could then decide to open the border in order to then create a problem for the European Union. And we have already seen that when once Turkey has reopened its borders to Greece, and some thousands of then migrants went to Greece with an immediate reaction of the Greek and the European authorities. But this happened once. It could maybe happen more and more in the future. And we see also that, for instance, now there are discussions with Tunisia on the basis of an agreement that has been signed with the European Union. And Tunisia doesn't seem to be keen to control its borders for the benefit of the European Union. I'm afraid that we will have to pass through a terrible crisis in order to progress and then have European Union more integrated in the area of migration and asylum. And I think also that we have to keep in mind that circumstances may change. Nowadays, the top priority politically is the fight against irregular migration. We don't have to forget that we have in the European Union an aging and declining population. And already now, member states need migrants to do some jobs that Europeans do not want to do. And interestingly, even governments very opposed to migration, like Hungary or like Italy, are planning to take tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of migrants on their labor market. So it means that there will be a real need. Circumstances may change, and the political priority in the future could then be to find the migrants that we need. And then in that scenario, I think that actually it would not really then be necessary anymore to transform the European Union into a fortress. That would be a positive scenario. Now, the big problem is that actually it's not clear that the persons arriving irregularly to the European Union, and in particular asylum seekers, are the persons that we accept on the labor market. And it would really be a kind of paradox, if not schizophrenia, If on the one hand, the European Union was trying to transform itself into a fortress against irregular migration and asylum seekers, while on the other hand, it would try to recruit migrants for the labor market's needs. So, but it's, of course, a very incorrect political question. To which extent is it necessary to take on board irregular migrants and asylum seekers arriving at the European borders and to accept them on the labor market? That could be one way of dealing with the issue of migration.
To wrap everything up, I posed a choice of two questions to Dr. Schneider. Either what would a future migration crisis look like if the EU made no change in migration policy it stands today, or two, what kind of crisis would it actually take to make meaningful change? He drew some important lessons from what we can take from Ukraine today.
I think I'll choose for a mixture of both, because the Ukrainian refugee crisis was actually something which answers to both questions in a way, because to take in those 4.2 million refugees from Ukraine in just a couple of months, the EU was extremely able to act. And it activated a legal ground that has been sort of sleeping and almost been in a grave, and that was the Temporary Protection Directive that was sort of resurrected or even used for the first time just because of this refugee crisis. So it needed this particular refugee crisis of an aggressive war on European territory by a third country producing millions of refugees to act really together within just a few days and to find a solution that includes some mechanism of solidarity, a mechanism of extremely quick protection for many millions of people. And what we have to do now, what the European Union has to do now, is draw the right lessons out of this activation. And we're still just at the first part. We succeeded in activating this legal basis and in taking in those refugees and in hosting them and feeding them and trying to integrate them. But the second question will be, and this will decide upon the success of the whole crisis to change the system, can we learn for future crises? So what do we do when the temporary protection ends? Do we send them back into misery? Do we find solutions to extend temporary protection? Do we keep up the free movement that the Ukrainians have now within the European Union? Or do we get back to rather defensive way in trying to, you know, really get rid of them? And the next refugee crisis from external Europe, out of Europe. This was a European refugee crisis with Ukrainians coming in, who are now candidates for EU accession, but the next crisis from external areas will be sort of the testing ground for the fact whether the EU has learned from that and is able to react to these sudden refugee crises. And I'm slightly positive that there will be some learning from that Ukrainian experience, but I'm not really sure we will stand another test like we did, at least Germany did stand in 2015-16 with the Syrian refugee crisis.